Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening around the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, and I'm joined again by my co-hosts, Rodney McCune and Ozan Ibrahim. Gents, wonderful to see you both.
Good to be with you.
Well, a lot to cover in international politics this week, but we're going to start in the UK, where very recently a petition on the Parliament's website has generated more than 2 million signatures calling for a new general election, something that Prime Minister Starmer has dismissed on in a television interview in the morning, saying, well, my focus is on the decisions that I have to make every day. And, you know, that traditional line that all politicians run, saying the only poll that matters is on the one that is on election day, which, of course, in the UK is still very, very far away. Rodney, we've discussed this a couple of times on the podcast that Starmer hasn't gotten off on the, I guess, the right foot or the start that he probably would have wanted given the election results. 2 million signatures on the parliamentary website. Does that really mean anything?
Well, it's significant, and then it created a news story that's another problem for Labour to have to deal with. But in terms of it actually triggering a general election, you know, it's not going to happen. We're not going to have another election. We can't have electoral cycles dictated by either people who didn't support a party at an election a couple of months ago deciding to sign a petition, or people who did support a party over a five-year cycle then deciding they've got some bizarre buyer's remorse and they want to return their new jumper to the store. I mean, that's not how elections work, I'm afraid. There'll be plenty of opportunities through by-elections and other things during the term of the parliament for voters to register their opposition to various things. But this government hasn't really got started yet, never mind it's time for a change. And a change to who? You know, the Conservatives have just elected their leader. They were so disorganised. Well, maybe this is unfair. They might have been so creative and thought is one view, or they were so disorganised is the other. They were so disorganised that when it came to Starmer being away during Prime Minister's questions last week, the convention tends to be that the Deputy Prime Minister takes over for PMQs, and Kemi Badenoch hadn't actually appointed a Deputy Prime Minister. So they had no one to face off against the Deputy Prime Minister during Prime Minister's questions, which is, of course, a big thing in the UK. And they had to then say that they're going to use a rotation basis to fill that seat, which struck me that they're not actually ready. So you can't really have a petition to replace a government with an opposition that has no positions really on many things. But you also can't have it in a whim in the sort of the aftermath and some buyer's remorse of a general election. And of course, we don't know who the signatories are. They're not necessarily registered voters. They might just be Nigel Farage's TikTok following for all we know. But there you go. So yes, it's a news story. Yes, it's annoying for Labour. Is it going to trigger an election? No.
Ozan, given your, interest and also experience in politics, is it something that Starmer should be worried about, that there's just this enormous number of people signing petitions now?
Look, I think as Rodney said, it feeds into the narrative that Starmer's had a pretty rough start. He doesn't seem like he's in control, whether that's the reality or not. I suppose that's to be debated. I think this is just a silly media story. Now, the petition, as Rodney touched on, there are reports of many of those signatories not being actually genuine. Of course, Elon Musk, who played a very influential role in the US elections, also kind of is trying to meddle in the UK elections as well, considering the issues that he's facing on the social media front. But he's shared the petition. You know, the usual suspects, Nigel Farage, shared the petition. More than 10 million people voted against Keir Starmer. And as Rodney mentioned, 2.5 million want to have another shot. I think this makes a mockery of the whole democratic process. I'm betting that there are many, many other issues that people could actually use this petition process for, to put in front of the parliament for debate, issues that actually really, really impact people's lives. And I think this is just a silly trick. It's a publicity stunt, and yeah, I don't, as Rodney says, I This is not how elections work. This is not how democracies work. And the quicker that Keir Starmer can kind of get over this and focus on his policies and on his agenda, the better for him and the Labour Party.
What does he need to do now to take things, I guess, to the next level, Rodney? I mean, we've talked about him struggling. Yes, it's only been 4 months since he's taken office, and of course, these things do take time and policy positions and implementations, etc. But now with the election of Donald Trump in the US, the incredible sort of showing, I guess, of the right and Trump supporters in all aspects of US life, what does Starmer need to do to regain popularity and also, I guess, confidence from the British?
From my perspective, they don't really have clarity around the narrative or direction and the overall communications of the government. And it feels like it's constantly reactive. But the things that they need to anchor, what they're saying and what they're doing in, they do have. It's just that the news stories aren't there to attach it so that we can start to see that emerge. And I wonder whether they really need to redouble their efforts across government, where they look right across departments, what's happening, have a much more effective, because I'm sure they do have an organized system. So I'm not going to say organized, but they have a much more effective system of mining those good news stories and getting a pipeline of them to come out, and then explain where they fit into the overall big idea. And that way they'll find that they will be seen by the public as moving in a particular direction. And it's not just about the stories that the opposition or those who are opposed to the government, so not necessarily the formal opposition, want to be out there, such as inheritance tax. You know, it was a it, on farmers. I mean, this goes back to what was being used by the wealthy as a land dodge to buy land, not to necessarily farm it, but to use it as a tax get around on inheritance tax. That's what they've tried to close, and they've done it in a way that hasn't brought farmers with them as to why they're necessarily doing this and what the real impact will be and how many farms are over a certain value. That this will bite on at a reduced rate over a longer period of time. That's their story around this particular policy. But they haven't got to the point where either the rest of the public are saying, yeah, we can't have this tax dodge, this is the right thing to do, or a significant percentage of farmers are saying, yeah, we understand the policy too. It doesn't actually affect us. It only affects a small number of people, and we can see why that happens as well. So they're really sort of failing to communicate, failing to bring people with them because they're failing to communicate. And then they're failing to balance the challenging points with that pipeline of good news, which should be coming out across government, other departments, where ministers are getting on with their jobs and actually delivering positive outcomes. That's what they need to do, in my view.
I'm going to be a devil's advocate here, but how much of it is really that the government or Keir Starmer is not communicating the message? And how much of it is that he's faced with a extremely hostile and extremely conservative media landscape? I mean, it's almost the inverse of, I mean, we've heard Trump talk about for the last 10 years that the mainstream media is against him. It almost is the case from an outsider's point of view that the mainstream media in the UK is certainly against a Labour government and is quite significantly conservative in just its makeup. Maybe it's time that they start to get a lot of this, you know, or an independent media ecosystem starts to further develop, and you know, you start to have much more unbiased media, and you know, much of what is happening in the US. I mean, mainstream media, we saw with the MSNBC sale coming up, you know, legacy media is dying in the US. It's been taken over by both on the right and the left, and then the middle, this independent ecosystem. Maybe that's where the UK needs to go for to have an actual healthy public debate around issues. Because I've, you know, I'm whether it's Sky, whether it's the tabloids, the media certainly isn't helping him. But also, I don't think the media in the UK is helping public discourse.
The hostile media landscape's been the same for every Labour government, I'm going to say. The difference, Suzanne, is that when New Labour were in government and they were being challenged by a right of centre media, whether it be the Telegraph or whatever, Blair not only had some great people around him, in terms of, ministers and ability there, he also had Alistair Campbell and Peter Mandelson, in the background initially, and then in the foreground, certainly where Mandelson was concerned, continually working at this stuff in order to get the right balance in terms of what was getting briefed out, what achievements were there, and what positives there were in terms of the government. I just don't see that Keir Starmer has that at the moment. And your mind goes back to New Labour, especially with John Prescott passing away in recent days, but the important role he provided in connecting Blair, who was a posh boy, who went to a posh school, and came upon the Labour leadership in circumstances which couldn't have been predicted, in the passing of John Smith, who was then leader of the opposition, and John Prescott was excellent at grounding Blair's leadership and ensuring Blair's leadership remained attached to what was the traditional Labour base. Labour currently under Starmer don't feel like they have that attachment, and that base is able, therefore, to be exploited by the likes of Farage and so on. And so I think the team around Starmer isn't as strong as it has been in the previous significant Labour government that came in off a similar landslide victory. And I think certainly the sooner that team toughens up, or the sooner that he decides to make changes and potentially improve that team where necessary, the better the outcomes that there'll be for the government.
I completely agree with you on Blair surrounding himself with absolute geniuses. I suppose the other issue is Blair. I mean, if you're trying to spin the media and spin politics, it would have been a much easier landscape to do it back in Blair's days than it is today, with such a fragmented media,
Yeah,
and
agreed.
many people getting their news and forming their opinions not on actual, informed media or news, but 30-second TikTok kind of clips. So, yeah, anyway, interesting one.
Well, the other thing that, of course, came up in terms of spokespeople for Starmer and people around him was their reaction to the news that the International Criminal Court is wanting to, or has issued warrants to arrest Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense chief for war crimes, something that the UK has not ruled out doing if Prime Minister Netanyahu does indeed visit the UK, saying that they would oblige, or sorry, they would comply rather with international law. It has always done so and will always continue to do so, was the essence of the quote. So that places an interesting predicament, I guess, if indeed Netanyahu chooses to travel there. But what's the meaning of these arrest warrants, Ozan, to Netanyahu, to the ongoing war in Gaza? Is it just symbolic, or is it more than that?
I think it's nothing. It's symbolic, but that doesn't mean I think it's not important. And also, it's not just Netanyahu. I think they've also included the leadership of Hamas in that as well, which I think sends a very strong signal to the world that, that a reset is required. And as we've talked about many times on this podcast, I think a reset is required. What's happening in that region is awful. What happened on October 7 was awful. But there's just no political way out. And so I don't think it has a tangible or practical meaning, but I think it sends the right message to the world that as long as you have people, leaders like Netanyahu and the leadership of Hamas, this issue is not going to get resolved.
Yeah, look, from my perspective, you can't sign up to international treaties and then cherry pick whether you decide to take action on something like an arrest warrant. The good news, I suspect, for the UK in terms of diplomacy is that it's unlikely that he's going to turn up in London for some New Year's celebrations and then the government be challenged to act or not act. So, because in a different circumstance, someone, may wish to challenge a government who they know would be, or a nation they know would be uncomfortable in affecting something like the arrest warrant. But it's not going to happen in this case. So he's not going to go there. No one's going to be disappointed that he doesn't.
I think he's much more welcome at Mar-a-Lago than London these days, anyway.
100%.
Well, let's speak of Mar-a-Lago and indeed the man who occupies that space and will shortly be occupying the White House, President-elect Donald Trump, who has appointed some incredible names to lead some various government departments, as well as, in his cabinet as well. He's definitely off to a firing start. We always said it would be an interesting 4 years, now with the renewed or Trump presidency 2.0. Ozan, what's been your thoughts as you've sort of watched Donald Trump outline sort of name after name in to join him and his team to govern the US for the next 4 years?
Well, I mean, if you don't laugh, you're going to cry. So it's been an emotional roller coaster, and one that I think was expected. I think the show has begun. To Donald Trump's credit, this is something that he said from the outset that he's going to shake things up, and he's certainly doing that. And I think it's not to be unexpected. I think it's the strategy seems to be that if you put, if you put a enough problematic nominees up and give the senators, particularly some of them who continue to take their job as senators seriously, and if you give them an opportunity to do their job, to review and provide advice on the suitability and the fitness of these candidates, you give them a couple of wins, but at the end of the day, he ends up getting some of the reality is Marco Rubio looks like a great selection out of a pretty bad lot, I've got to say. I think no surprise that Matt Gaetz had to pull out, and it's I think that had a lot to do with his problems with the Ethics Committee of the House of Representatives, which again the report I guess will never be released. And then you've got RFK Jr. I heard this morning that Hulk Hogan believes that he's also going to be tapped on the shoulder for a job in the administration. So I'd like to see what that job would be, and more importantly, what he'll be wearing to his first day at work in the White House. But look, these are, I think, things that were to be expected. I think the bigger concerns for me are around having people who are not necessarily going to go through a nomination process, but are going to be in a position where they will wield significant power, and not just for the US, but I think will undertake decisions that will have significant consequences for the world economy. And I talk about people like Vivek Ramaswamy and Elon Musk, who in Elon Musk's case seems to have camped out in Mar-a-Lago for the last 3 weeks. And there's quite a lot of memes, etc., going around that he's become the first lady, Elonia, etc. But jokes aside, what they plan to do with this Dodge, DOGE, Department of Government Expenditure, if they do what they're setting out to do, I think is going to be quite a concern. And I think people should be focused on some of those people who have incredible power without having to go through a Senate confirmation process. I mean, they're talking about cutting $2 trillion from the US budget, in an environment where, the US economy, if you look at the numbers, are looking pretty good. But they themselves are arguing that there will be some short-term pain, but for the long-term gain. You don't have to be an expert to know that there's not just $2 trillion of fat lying around. I think they're going to have to look at cutting significant services for people. And this is going to create some not only political problems for them, but I think it's going to be a major problem from the economic point of view. So I'm, in summary, amused by some of the cabinet picks, horrified by others. But you know, we knew that it was going to be a show, and you know, it's been a top rating show. I think everyone has been following it with great interest.
Yeah, I mean, like, I thought it was a freak show of announcements of 1980s television celebrities for a long period of time. I'm pleased to hear that Hulk Hogan still has a shout of some ruling government. My favorite so far has been Marjorie Taylor Greene at the Department of Government Efficiencies, where she's going to be forced to work with Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, and we'll see how that goes as a I can imagine them finding common ground on so much socially that they could become great friends out of this process. I think she's already announced that she wants to, and this is the point about this government efficiency. It's, you know, she's gone in there. It's about government efficiency. The first thing she said she wants to cut is sanctuary cities, those that are soft on immigration, in her view, and provide support for immigrants, that they just want to cut their funding. That's not an efficiency. That's a punitive financial measure in order to force a change in policy at a sub-federal level. And if that's what it's going to be used for, then it's a very different beast than the one that was announced early on as a joke about Bitcoin or whatever it happens to be, that of course isn't a real government department. And maybe if Laura Loomer or someone gets an appointment, they'll be inspired again to start looking at how crazy some of them are. But yeah, there's some wild picks. Robert Kennedy Jr. I don't know. But let's see. Let's see whether they do what they say, and let's see whether they've always believed what they've told people they believed. Because there's a world of difference between being in opposition or shouting from the sidelines and having responsibility, active responsibility for a government department when, you know, it becomes a much more complicated task.
I do wonder if the new Trump presidency, though, is going to be, what's the word I'm looking for here? More realistic for him than what perhaps the previous one was. I mean, he came to Washington and the White House, obviously having no experience in politics. He ran a completely chaotic White House, and you know, that's been well documented and a story that's well been told. This time he comes in with a different mindset, right? He knows what the expectations are. He knows what he needs to do and what he doesn't need to do. He understands what the lifestyle of a US president is, even though, you know, he's definitely not sort of typical in terms of how previous presidents were. And then I wonder how all of that mindset has played into his decision making around the people that have supported him throughout this process and what these people could actually do. I mean, to your point, Rodney, it's easy to say something. It's much harder when, you know, Vivek and Elon come to the head of Dodge and sit down and try to make some pretty brutal decisions and then wonder what will happen both economically and socially to the country. And he didn't really have that level of I guess support or network around him the first time around, right? It was a very sort of Trump-driven top-down approach. Now it feels like he's building a team, he's assembling in many ways the next generation of leadership to take the US to the direction that they believe that it should be taken to. To me, it's much more interesting this time around. I mean, last time it was a theater of the absurd, right? And I think even the strongest Trump supporters would agree that it was definitely out of character for a White House, but it was a little bit chaotic and it was a little bit crazy. This time it feels a bit different to me. And I think, you know, a lot of the media and indeed including us on this show are reacting similar to how we probably reacted the first time round. But I do wonder what the differences will be and how it will play out. But I guess time will tell.
I don't think experience is going to change how he behaves. I think the only thing he's learned from the experience of the first term is that he probably didn't go far enough in terms of appointing people he wanted to appoint, and probably was slightly more cautious. I just don't think that there's a sense of responsibility that's going to descend on this administration, unless it does within individuals who, as we said, when they find themselves behind the levers of power, feel slightly different about the whole thing. But there was more cautious people appointed by him last time round. They're not as cautious this time, whether that be and maybe just not. And maybe it's unfair to say they're not as able, but they certainly don't bring the same level of global or international experience to their position of responsibility in the same way that previous defense secretaries would have done, and so on.
I mean, I think, the biggest difference in terms of what we see now compared to excuse me, to last time is that last time he still had to rely significantly on the Republican establishment to fill many of his cabinet posts. This time he's really surrounded himself with some ideologues, someone like Stephen Miller, who really believes in this MAGA, kind of ideology, America First ideology, and at this point in time, the first criteria seems to be, are you going to be loyal to Donald Trump? So therefore, I suspect it may still be a chaotic second term. Probably for different reasons, less so, I think, from the point of the personnel. Now, saying that, I think one of the things that you might see is, when it comes to things like foreign policy, and you've got someone like Marco Rubio, which I assume he's going to get confirmed, how he's got a very different perspective on how to deal with, particularly the Russia-Ukraine conflict, than many of his counterparts in the MAGA wing of the party. So you may see in bits and pieces of the administration significant tensions, but I think this time around he's really solidified his people around him based on the fact that he knows they will be loyal, and he's put an interesting group of people together. Some of them are not too bad, I think. I think the Treasury Secretary, from what I can see, seems to have quite a bit of credibility, the nominee. But certainly, he's not beholden to the establishment wing of the Republican Party, mainly because it doesn't really exist anymore. So he can push his agenda through without very, very limited or with very limited resistance from within.
Well, it was definitely the election that had all our eyes firmly cast on it in this year of elections. And with the year now wrapping up, it's time to still pump out a few more. Ironically, of course, we know that the number of elections this year has been extraordinary, including a few surprise ones. But one that is, of course, close to Rodney's heart will be the election happening in Ireland this weekend or Friday, which marks the end of a 3-week campaign since the dissolution, I should say, of Parliament. Rodney, take us through who the main players are and what you think will happen on Friday and beyond.
As I'm sure most people very focused on Irish elections will know, it's been a coalition government of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael over the preceding term. The last election, it was a three-way split with Sinn Féin. I think we're one seat behind Fianna Fáil, and then Fine Gael were in third place. But was it like 38, 37, 35 or so on in terms of seats? And the two establishment parties formed a coalition, which has of course taken them through the likes of COVID and Brexit and some big issues that the government's dealt with that have affected Ireland over the previous term. The players are the same in terms of Sinn Féin, led by Mary Lou McDonald, and Fianna Fáil and Micheál Martin. And then there's been a change in leadership at Fine Gael, with Simon Harris, who is young but looks old, is young but sounds slightly old, but he's taken over from Leo Varadkar as Fine Gael leader. Listen to an interesting interview with him on Sky within the past day or two, and he's dealing with the issues of being a new leader. I think he took over 7 months ago from Varadkar, but having been part of a government of a much longer time. So he's trying to campaign partially on the record, partially as a change candidate from his predecessor, and definitely focused on the future. But that can be a challenge in itself when the public might feel tired of a particular party or whatever in government. So I think he's certainly got challenges, a little bit like some of those that Kamala Harris had in the US elections. In terms of the main issues, immigration's a big issue. In of itself now in Ireland, immigration's a big issue. The number of asylum seekers has increased to the extent where, rather than being able to be managed in the larger urban areas, migrants or asylum seekers are being dispersed across the smaller communities, and it's creating a level of tension. One of the biggest issues in Ireland over the previous election cycle, and certainly in the last election, was housing, which hasn't really been solved. Housing cost and a shortage of housing, and the immigration or migrant issue or crisis has added to that, where there is an increased burden on a resource which is already scarce, and it's playing into the sort of the more right of centre populism which we've seen across Europe. The one thing which does appear to be the case is none of the big three parties are in a strong position to exploit that properly, and there isn't a strong emerging horse on the right which might really effectively do so. So it's possible, given that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have been in government during the period, and Sinn Féin aren't well positioned to exploit migrant crisis, that it's not going to skew the outcome of this election as it has done for so many others over the past election cycle. And they've even sort of got a novelty, well, I say a novelty candidate, an unusual candidate who's running for the Irish Dáil, which is a parliament, who is a guy called Jerry the Monk Hatch, who's well reported over many years has been involved in armed robberies, cash in transit type things, and at least one of the two largest in Irish history. He stood trial for murder and was acquitted in recent years for a very significant attack on a boxing weigh-in in Dublin with a rival crime gang where someone was killed. But he's now seems to be free of that charge and some others. And yes, he's running for a Dublin constituency. When I first heard of him and his nickname, I wondered whether he was called the monk because he was particularly pious, or because he had a fondness for large hoods to cover his to act as a disguise. But in fact, apparently it's because he's pious, which is even more amusing. Now, and the history of these candidates are they don't tend to win these elections. But if he does, that's another oddity in terms of Irish political life, in the same way that from the Norse perspective, Sinn Féin was very much attached to the IRA during a long period of criminality, and it's one of the reasons why there's a reluctance in the South Republic of Ireland, this is, for them to be in government. And one of the drivers behind Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael having this sort of establishment coalition during the last election. So all remains to be seen. And Sinn Féin themselves has had a bit of a scandal during the election. I should add this in probably too, where they've had some people within their own party who have been convicted of paedophilia, and another who's had accusations, and they have not acted in a way that's been seen to have properly investigated and dealt with the issue. And there's been sort of a suggestion of cover up because of reputational damage to the party and so on. And that's been another one of those pre-election stories, which has sort of knocked them back a little bit. But it all remains to be seen. In the polls that I've seen, it all seems to be pretty close again. And it seems to be potentially the same order as last time, albeit that Fine Gael, who currently hold the Taoiseach, but because of a transfer, an agreed transfer during the term of the last parliament, positioned Taoiseach's prime minister. It may well be that they do okay, rejoin a coalition with Fianna Fáil, but that Simon Harris's tenure as prime minister Taoiseach comes to an end because they're no longer the senior party in terms of the negotiation. But let's see what happens. It should be without the same sort of issues that we've seen in Moldova and Georgia and now in Romania. So we expect a sort of a conventional e election outcome for Ireland.
How lame. But by the way, I have some breaking news. Since we've been talking, the count on the signatures to call the general election has gone up from 2.545 million to 2.552 million. So in this time, 7,000 other people have signed it. Maybe
Probably
they
because
know
we've been
something we
talking
don't.
about it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, look, the Brexit petition got 6 million, at least, or over 6 million, the cancel Brexit. So I think
And I mean,
they have to hit at least 7 million for something to happen.
I don't want to revisit the topic, but I just read the call to action, and it says, "I believe the current Labour Party, sorry, the current Labour government, have gone back on the promises they laid out in the lead up to the last election."
I think we agree they campaigned on nothing at the last election and made no promises so they wouldn't have to break any.
Well, I mean, even if they did, I mean, give the poor guys a shot. I mean, they've been in government for 5 months. Like, you know, it's a 5-year term for a reason.
Yeah.
Like, give them a chance. Anyway, so we digress.
Yeah, that's Ireland. Any questions, Suzanne? I think you'll just probably be, you probably have a lie-in for this one. You'll not be staying up late, I'm sure.
Well, I know it's fascinating. It's just one that I haven't been following, and I've really not got anything of substance to say. Not that that's stopped me in the past, but yeah, this one I think you've covered up really well.
I think there's a serious election fatigue on the part of all of us who observe politics worldwide at the
Absolutely.
moment. But just to finish off on a really light note, let's head to your corner of the world, Ozan. What on earth is happening in Laos?
I hope that the listeners can pick up on your sarcasm there. Yes, in Rodney and myself, or my part of the world, we've had some very unfortunate or an unfortunate instance of a mass alcohol poisoning, or to be precise, methanol poisoning, in a in Laos, in a town which I believe is about 2 hours away from the capital, and it's an town that's been known, Van Veen is the name. It's been known for a long time as a bit of a party capital. It went through a significant re-imaging, rebranding to turn it into more of a kind of eco-tourism and kind of hiking and activities type of town. But sadly, in the last 2 weeks, six people have lost their lives, six tourists, and I think four of them stayed at a place called the Nana Hostel, and they lost their lives after falling sick from drinking tainted alcohol. So I had to do some reading about this in terms of the methanol poisoning. My take on it, or my thinking of it, was that it's added on to alcohol, and this is not uncommon for this region. Obviously, this sort of behavior happens in other parts of the world as well, where people add in methanol to what should be ethanol ingredients in alcohol to give it a bit of a kick, but also because it's much cheaper than ethanol. But obviously, there's found out that there's also another way it can also end up in the alcohol that people drink, and that is through poor distilling and poor processes in distilling. Apparently, methanol occurs naturally through the distillery process, but obviously, in a proper distillery, one that has standards and quality control, etc., that methanol is burnt out, and you're left with ethanol, which is obviously safe for human consumption. So yeah, it's going to hurt Laos, I think, from a tourism point of view, and it's also a bit of a wake up call to many in this region, because Laos is not the only country that has this problem. Illicit alcohol, counterfeiting, homemade alcohol, etc. This is a significant problem in this region, and some of it is for done by people who are trying to make extra profits at the expense of human life and human health. Others are people who just don't know how to distill their alcohol, and because of price, I suppose, pressures, those on lower income try to make their own homemade alcohol and end up poisoning themselves and others who share a drink with them. So yeah, it's a bit of an issue in this part of the world, and I hope that this story has certainly gotten quite a bit of global coverage, but I hope that governments can come together and bring about some proper regulations so that it stops really jeopardizing the great tourism product that this part of the world has to offer, whether it's in Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand, etc. I'm sure you would agree with that, Rodney, as someone who's had the privilege and pleasure of experiencing the tourism product in this region. I hope they can resolve this.
No, 100%, and so many of the countries in this region are less well off than the likes of Singapore, where we are, and therefore, tourism is an important part of not just GDP, but of the economic activity of many less well off people's survival. Obviously, it's principally a human tragedy, and it has happened in Cambodia and Malaysia and the Philippines in recent years with methanol poisoning. But the difference this time is in Laos, it's been foreign tourists who have lost their lives, and in many ways, it's every parent's nightmare that their university age child goes off to backpack around the world, and then something tragic like this does happen. And you're right in terms of regulation and so on going forward. But I do think as a result of this, the Laos tourism product's going to take a hit.
Yeah.
And yet it is a wonderful place with wonderful people and well worth visiting. So I hope that any hit is temporary. I hope that the government get round to regulating and reducing the risk around these things in the future, and that people, especially from the likes of Australia and so on, and Europe, do continue to travel to the likes of Laos and Cambodia and enjoy the many fun activities that they have on offer for backpackers and those types of tourists.
Well, indeed, let's hope it's a wake-up call for the governments that do govern, the regulations, or in this context, the lack thereof. A somber note to end on, gents, but it was lovely speaking to you both this week. See you next.
Thanks, Erdem. Looking forward to hearing you on the Guardian podcast in the next day or two.
Well, give the context now, Rodney, just before we sign off.
There's someone who's copying your voice, beautiful as it is, and therefore a voice worth copying, who does the main Guardian podcast, which comes out weekly, which is one of those that I listen to. Yeah, it's a good podcast. It's always very well researched and it's interesting, just like this one, of course. And I think when I first pointed out the voice of the key presenter, again, just like this one, to you were quite confused and thought it might have been you. And not just that, when you did play, it's called Today in Focus. When you did play Today in Focus on the Guardian for, I think it was your daughter, she asked whether it was you as well.
She actually did.
Well,
She
he does
asked
have a
if it
brilliant voice, much like you. He does have a
Yes.
brilliant voice, Adam. Unfortunately, RFK Jr. seems to be copying my voice. So it's.
Well, for those who don't,
We'll
Michael
discuss about the
Suffy.
worm in the ear thing then next week.
Michael Suffy is the journalist's name. He's the international correspondent for The Guardian. And I think we do sound alike, though, with his wonderful British accent. Maybe we should tag him in this podcast and see if he listens. It really is time to sign off, gents.
I've never seen both of you in the same room.
Love it. I love it.
Well, a much better note to end on. So thank you both.
I think we needed that. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroku Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.